Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, we got a full house this morning.
We most certainly do. We even have paparazzi and entourage with us this morning, so that's going to be fun. So here in a little bit, we're going to get a chance to have back on the Business Radio X microphone Dr. Laura Flusci. She's with Museum of Design. And we're going to get a chance to visit with Maurice Cherry. It's the smallest business card and the biggest personality I've seen in such a long time, so I can't wait for that segment. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Senior Managing Director, U.S. Southeast RMD, with a little company some of you may recognize called Accenture, Mr. Jimmy Etheridge. How are you, man?
Great, Stone. Happy to be the opening act here today.
So, Jimmy, as the opening act, what is Accenture doing for folks nowadays?
Well, it's a very exciting time, of course. Technology has become a part of everything an organization does, whether it's a public or a private sector. And with Accenture, we have a unique business model where we have strategy, we have consulting, we have a digital organization, technology, as well as operations. And so it's all over the board. But in general, what we're doing is working with clients in how they can change their business model, leveraging some of the newer technologies like cloud, mobility, analytics, that kind of thing.
And you're new to this position at Accenture?
Yes. Old to Accenture, new to this position. So I've been with the company for over 30 years. And we had a reorganization to put more emphasis on our local markets and local communities.
Is that the first reorg that Accenture ever had?
Nope.
But I doubt it.
Nope. We, just like we talk to our businesses about and clients about being nimble all the time, we try to take our own medicine. But we have, I had spent the last 5 years running North America across a number of our industry sectors, and we have shifted to a model that's really looking at things through more of a regional lens. Mm-hmm. So effective December 1st, we set up these five regions. I run the Southeast, so that's 10 states from D.C. down to Miami. You know, it's a fantastic job, and I'm really excited about it.
So how do you attack a region as opposed to like a local market?
Well, we have been probably one of the best examples of a virtual company for a long time. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of fantastic things about it. I honestly don't know of another organization that's able to bring together the skill sets that we are on demand for our clients. However, the downside is we're sometimes not as visible in some of the local markets. And really with this regional focus, what I tend to look at is the metropolitan locations. And so while I'm running the Southeast, what I'm very focused on is what are we doing in DC? What are we doing in Charlotte? What are we doing in Atlanta, Tampa, Miami, et cetera?
So now in Atlanta, can you share some of the goals and strategies?
Absolutely. It's a fantastic market to be in. I'm pretty active with the Metro Chamber, sit on the executive committee. And I think if you look at this Atlanta market, there's some unique attributes that that you've got, ranging from a fantastic fintech environment, a wonderful global health. You know, you've got Emory, CDC, et cetera. You've got the kind of the IoT or mobility based upon the old, you know, Bell South, AT&T space, a growing cybersecurity space. So these are exactly the kind of things that we spend a lot of our time working with clients on. So for me, it's about spending more time here locally in Atlanta with the clients that we have, some of the companies that we want to be doing more with, and probably continuing along those same themes.
So now, how do the companies leverage the strengths of Atlanta? Do you help them kind of look at the city and you go, okay, we have an international airport, we have great universities. Do you help them attract talent in here? Like, what aspects are you helping them with?
I would say a lot of what we're doing right now is really helping them around their business model and looking at how they want to adapt to be more competitive, or perhaps even on a more aggressive strategy, be disruptive. Mm-hmm. And part of that is certainly leveraging, leveraging technology and our technology capabilities, but a lot of it is talent driven. We just came out with Tech Vision 2017, talks about some of the key trends. And one of the things that we talk about is the importance of the human aspect of what's happening with technology. So working with some of the local clients on how they do their talent strategy and equip their employees for this new future is definitely what we do.
So when you're working with them, what do those initial conversations look like? I mean, are you bringing all the knowledge of Accenture worldwide into helping them?
Yeah.
One of the advantages?
Yes. I'll give you an example. With one of the larger organizations here, we did a workshop with the CEO and his leadership team. We came in and looked at what are some of the things that are challenging the organization today, taking some provocative points of view, like asking that leadership team, if you had unlimited funds and you wanted to compete against yourself, what would you do? How would you do it? Then we spent some time really looking at the art of the possible.
Well, talk about that a little bit, because I'd like to dig in there. Because, I mean, how many leaders are looking, you know, the last thing they want to do is even verbalize how I'm going to drive myself out of business, right? Like, yeah, that sounds pretty scary, right?
Yep.
But is that the type of, you're trying to kind of explore that, right?
Yes.
Because if you don't do it yourself, someone else is.
Precisely. And in some cases, as well, we share data and research that we do, in particular to show where sometimes that competition is not coming from where you think it's going to come from.
Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of times it isn't the person in the space that is the disruptor in the space. It's usually from kind of left field, right?
Correct. Yes.
So how do you get them to even change their mindset to even look beyond what they're
caters it with the varsity. You start that opens the minds, right? You get an FO going, and then
we'll use examples of other industries where you've mm-hmm. seen change. You know, let's look at what Uber has done, affecting everything from public transit to the automotive industry to things like that. We'll talk about how. And give some examples of where some of the competition might come from. The other thing we spend time going back to the point around the talent is really look at what are your employees saying about working for your organization, particularly as you're looking at millennials and this next generation of talent that you need to focus on. We use some sources of information, public research, Glassdoor, Fishbowl, things like that, to look at what the employees think about the company.
Now, are the companies embracing the fact that in a few years, I guess millennials will be the vast majority of the workforce, right?
Yes.
Within what, 5-10 years, the millennials will be 60-70% of the workforce?
Yes. Yes. It's some
that's
sectors
a major
faster. Yes.
Shift,
like
right?
For us already, that's the case.
And then so a lot of the times you have to reframe what even a job or a career path looks like.
Yes. One of the things I was having a meeting with a client 2 weeks ago that we talked about. He was asking how our culture has shifted. And I said, in our organization, for a long time, I guess kind of going back to baby boomer, Gen X, the focus was around work hard, play hard.
Mm-hmm.
So there was always the ethos that you're going to work hard, but we tried to create other types of events that made you feel part of a family and you could have fun as well. I think that's shifted a little bit to now what I call do well, do good. So our employees want to do well. They want to have challenging problems. They want to be able to leverage the full capabilities globally of Accenture to solve those problems. But not just do well, they want to do good. So they want to feel like they're having an impact, which again is part of my focus around local community. They want to have an impact around things that are happening around them.
Like a more meaningful life.
Yes. Yes.
Which is a big shift from an employer standpoint, right? Now you got to worry about that.
Yes, it is.
How does HR handle that?
Well, I think, part of it is creating that dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big shifts I've seen over the last year and a half within Accenture, we moved from what I would think of as a performance management to a performance achievement approach. So traditionally, a lot of the clients I work with, they run through a performance management approach. When you sit down to do your performance review, or maybe with Stone, you guys start talking about some of the good things that you've done, but then you begin to focus on, well, what are the weaknesses? What are the things I need to work on? And too much of the dialogue is really around what you don't do well and how to address that. With more of a focus around achievement and doing well, it's around what are you really good at And now how do we create more opportunities for that? So the analogy I tend to use with clients is, it's like having a tennis coach, and maybe you're really good at your forehand and you're not as good at your backhand, and having all the time spent trying to work on that weaker backhand instead of, how do I come up with a strategy where you can leverage the forehand more often?
That's right. And then just leverage your superpower, so you're doing it more often for more people. And that way you have greater impact.
Yes, exactly.
Now, one of the innovative things that you guys are doing are these innovation hubs. Can you share a little bit about what's happening in Atlanta? And is it only in Atlanta, or is it throughout the Southeast, these innovation hubs?
Well, so we announced on Friday that we're going to have 10 innovation hubs open up before 2020. Actually, I guess three parts of that. 10 innovation centers here in the U.S., $1.4 billion investment in training of our employees to be able to do the kind of challenging work that our clients want. And as well, we're going to create 15,000 jobs here in the U.S. So when you look at those 10 innovation centers, Atlanta will be one of those. We already have some components of that. We have a creative studio here in Atlanta, but when we talk about that innovation center, we're talking about everything from a startup incubator environment to a studio where we can go develop innovative solutions very rapidly with agility, to a demonstration center where we can take clients and show them, here's how technology is working in your industry. So Atlanta will be one of those hubs.
So can you walk us through what it's like? So when you approach your client and say, hey, we have this new innovation hub in Atlanta, can you share how you explain to them how they best can leverage it?
Sure. So, you know, part of it, what we talk about is, you know, if it's at the senior levels, it might be being able to get their leadership team offsite together. You know, just the example that we were discussing here earlier, Lee, if we're going to have a conversation about how you might compete against yourself, you need to have a special relationship with a client. They need to trust you. You're obviously working with them on some strategic things, and they like the idea of getting away from their office location, being able to get really immersed, fully immersed in an environment where we can show them things. You know, we opened the Houston Innovation Center timed with a Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. You come walking in there and there's literally a drone flying around in the building. And we show some of the things that we're leveraging that drone to do in oil fields, agriculture, and some other places. But that's part of what they want. They want to literally get in there and see what it's like. I think they also want to understand a little bit about our secret sauce with our talent, our millennial talent, how our spaces are created to make more collaborative opportunities. So they really want to get in there and feel it. So what I tend to do is either, you know, kind of show them what we've got in some other places. Here's what's coming in Atlanta. Right now, that's, you know, the session that I was referring, we did up in New York, because I don't have all of that here in Atlanta yet.
It's on the roadmap.
Exactly.
Yeah. So now you mentioned that you're kind of new to this position, the specific, and you're covering 10 states. Can you share a little bit about how you see yourself as a leader and how you kind of motivate, inspire, and get the team all aligned with this vision?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in simple terms, there's three things in this role that I need to do. One is working with our clients around innovative solutions and helping them with their, you know, strategies and growth agenda. So very client-facing. So I spend time every week working with clients and client teams. The second is really around our employees and building the talent base here. So the Southeast as a region has a very big addressable market for us. There's a lot of market share for us to go get. I need to have the talent to do that. So I'm pretty active in recruiting our relationships into the university systems, as well as other sources that we have for talent. And then the third thing is really around the community and creating opportunities for our employees to work in the community and collaborate with our clients in the community. And that's ranging everything from grants that we do with some of the nonprofits here. You know, this past summer, we did an immersion program with Girls Who Code that's really focused around our diversity inclusion agenda in technology. So these three things, client-facing, building out our talent, and getting us engaged in the community are my main focus areas.
I got to say, early in the conversation, when you said you had 30 years in, at what you and I know 30 years ago was like one of the big four, the big eight or whatever, I did not expect the conversation to take this course. Everything you're saying, everything about the way you carry yourself and where you're investing your energy and resources is such a fresh perspective. What's the secret? You drinking wheatgrass or... I mean, seriously, you must be a change master or a change junkie or something. Can you speak to that, the way you decided to approach your career?
Well, I think I graduated from Georgia Tech. I came by my bias towards tech, honestly. My grandfather and father went there, so I didn't really have much of a choice. But coming out of school, I enjoyed my experience there. I got an industrial engineering degree, but I really didn't want to just be an engineer. I wanted the opportunity to do different things and see different industries. And honestly, when I took the job, my plan was to go work for what was Arthur Andersen, you know, one of the big eight before they became the big four, and go back and get an MBA. But I had such a great time with my experiences. I got to learn a lot of things. I always felt like I would be taking a step back to get off of that experience. And really, it's just the same, you know, it's the same today. I joke with our employees as one of the old guys that's been around for a long time that, you know, when I was at their junior levels, technology was a cost to be managed by clients, like gas, electricity, office space. And most of the dialogue I had with senior executives in my clients was, how can I minimize my spend on technology? And most of the time, if you look at how the analysts would look at our prospects, they would survey CIOs and ask CIOs, what's your IT budget look like next year? And depending upon their optimism or pessimism, that's how they would feel about us. Now, I tell these employees, you know, you're in the right place at the right time. An organization cannot communicate with a shareholder, a supplier, a customer, an employee, a regulatory agency without leveraging technology. And the CEOs I work with tend to joke with me that, you know, they used to know what they spent on technology because it was the CIO's budget. Today, they have no idea because everyone in their organization is spending on technology. So it's an exciting time for us.
Now, you mentioned the importance for your organization to immerse itself in the local community. Can you share some of the groups you're involved with here locally?
Sure. The Atlanta Chamber of Commerce, I've been a part of the MAC for a while, and I think it's a fantastic organization. The you know, a lot of times we talk about the Atlanta way here, but the way the educational institutions, the government, and our business leadership come together is fantastic. You know, in that context, last year we did an initiative for the Chamber, Educated Workforce, and really what we were looking at is, how do we do a better job of aligning our talent here locally in Atlanta with what is a booming and hopefully continuing to growing economy and that's generating jobs? So that's one area that I've always been pretty active. Georgia Tech is another. I sit on the board with the Athletic Association, Alexander Thorpe, and you know, have been a big Georgia Tech fan forever. And so that's another thing I spend a lot of time on. And then Boy Scouts. I've had two sons go through the program, and it's nothing I enjoy more occasionally than just getting away from technology and spending time out in the woods.
Now, Accenture, they're kind of industry agnostic, right?
Yes, we cross.
You mentioned technology a lot, but you serve other industries other than technology.
We apply that technology across 17 industries, and you'd probably be hard pressed when I say 17 to think of an industry sector that's not somehow part of those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then right now, what do you need more of? How can we help you?
I think, you know, as I said, a big part of what I'm trying to do is get talent. And, you know, we've got a lot of great opportunities and a lot of great opportunities here locally. I'm always looking for the opportunity to spend time with clients that think, you know, they could use Accenture's help. We're lucky we've got a nice big brand. Our Atlanta Business Chronicle just rated us one of the top 10 places to work, you know, here in Atlanta. And I think we were number 5 on the list of technology employee base here. So you know, most people here know who Accenture is, but, you know, I've often found that depending on their past experiences, they might think of us a bit more like a traditional big four, mm-hmm. you know, consulting firm. They might think of us more as a strategy firm. they might, some of them, the chief marketing officers I work with tend to know us more as like a creative agency because a lot of the acquisitions that we've done, including three here in Atlanta in the last 18 months. So part of what I'm always interested in getting help is getting time with those clients to see how many different innovative things that we do.
Now, what's the pain that a company's having where they go, we should call the folks at Accenture?
I would say, as you're looking at where is our growth going to come from, you know, a lot of companies have hit a bit of a wall around growth. Depending on what sector you're in, the ability to go acquire that growth in the M&A space may not be an effective answer. And so organically, how do we do it? I think many of them also are seeing one of the challenges to that growth is the fact that digital is making customer experiences across industries relevant. So the fact is, you may be the best in your sector around a customer experience, but if that fails in comparison to their experiences in retail or travel, it influences their perception of your organization. I think a second area that we spend a lot of time looking at is the cost transformation side. So for some of those things, I want to pivot my core business to the new. I've got to be able to afford that. Mm-hmm. How can I do that? How can I look at getting the right return on my core business that creates the funds that I need to invest in what that new space is going to be?
And if somebody wanted to learn more and have a more substantive conversation with you, is there a website or email or connect with you on LinkedIn? What's the best way for someone to get a hold of you?
www.accenture.com is fantastic. We have a great website there that talks in detail about all the capabilities that that I've talked about here. As for me personally, yes, it's probably LinkedIn.
So before I let you go, I ask most guests who come through here what they're reading. I'm not going to ask you that. I probably will after we go off air. What are you writing? Because if you write a book, I'll read it. Seriously, is there a book in you? Are you considering capturing this 30 plus years of experience and committing it to paper?
I still have a ways to go before I think I'm going to have the time, Stone, to do that. But maybe down the road.
I think you should. Well, it's been an absolute delight having you in the studio. Very informative, very encouraging. And folks, if you want to have a rewarding career in a field where you're genuinely serving folks, I think you got to include a conversation with the folks at Accenture. This has been fun, man. Thank you.
Thank you. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Hey, you going to hang out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Absolutely. I wouldn't leave this for the world.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio with Lunch, Mr. Maurice Cherry. Hey, man, did you learn anything in that last segment?
Oh, yeah, a lot. I didn't know Accenture was doing all of that. That's amazing. I've heard of some of the creative stuff, so I didn't know that you spread across 17 different sectors like that. That's amazing.
So, Maurice, you want to share a little bit about Lunch? What are you up to?
Sure. So, Lunch is a multidisciplinary creative studio here in Atlanta. We do web design, graphic design, email marketing. We do some strategy. We also do podcasting. Been around now for about 8 years. And that's Lunch.
You were doing podcasting before it was cool.
Yeah, I actually started podcasting way back in, I want to say maybe 2005 or so. And then I have been doing it for clients for a while, kind of did like my own personal shows and things. But now I have a current podcast that I've done for the past 4 years, a design podcast called Revision Path.
And Revision Path is one of a well-known podcast in the space. Right, you won some awards.
We won the 2015 Most Inspiring Design Podcast for the Creative Market Awards. So that was really a big honor. We were up against a lot of big names in that particular space for design podcasts. So we were really excited to get that.
Now, it seems kind of counterintuitive to have a podcast on design when your work is so visual. What made you want to leverage audio podcast for that?
Two reasons. I actually had the idea to do Revision Path back in 2006 when I was working on another project of mine called the Black Weblog Awards. I was a working designer. I knew several of my friends that were working designers, but we were not getting the same level of recognition or really any recognition for the work that we were doing compared to our peers. And so I wanted to do something along the lines that would showcase the work that we were doing, but I was working full-time. I was in graduate school full-time. I was doing the Black Weblog Awards on the side. I just didn't have the time to do it. It really wasn't until 2013 when I was well established in my business and had the time to do this that I wanted to say, let me go ahead and create this space and create this platform to make that happen. There's actually a lot of design podcasts out there, which they, I want to say that they tackle different parts of design. Some talk about design with entrepreneurship. Some talk about design along UX. For me, we talk about design and we kind of more so focus it on Black designers all around the world. But there's a lot of diversity, even if you narrow it down to just that. There's different types of designers. We're talking a wide range of diversity along age, geographic location, you name it.
So now you mentioned the Black Weblog Awards. That has been around for what, 10, at least 10 years, right?
It's over 10 years. I started it in 2004. So
yeah,
it's been
that's
around
like 13 years now.
Yeah, I sold it actually in 2011. So
it's not
I'm on. Well, I'm on in like a chairman emeritus type of role, but I do still keep in touch with the company that has purchased it. They still put on the event every year.
Mm-hmm. And that celebrates Black bloggers, podcasters, and video is also.
That's right. Very soon, it will be the longest running event of its kind, period. Very soon. I want to say maybe in about 3 or 4 years.
Now, how is the Black blogger, podcaster, video blogger community here in Atlanta?
It's pretty active, I would say. I mean, when you look at, you know, sort of to what Jimmy was saying, there's a big creative base here. Blogging is something that a lot of people, I think, really started to get into right around 2005. And as technology has increased, it's really sort of leveled the playing field in terms of getting involved. So there's a lot of people starting podcasts. There's a lot of people doing video blogs. I mean, you could even do it now from your phone or something. There's a lot of people that are in the space. There are regular meetups from what I've been to and from what I've heard. So I think we have a pretty active space here in Atlanta.
And then for your business, how do you go about attracting new clients for lunch?
Usually clients come in through referral. Like I said, we've been here for 8 years, so we have a pretty wide client base. It stems everywhere from nonprofits to healthcare to politics to small business, pretty wide swath of clients. We get a lot of referrals through our website. And on occasion, when I'm at conferences and I'm passing out cards, sometimes I will, you know, I'll get clients that way. But generally, it's through referrals.
And at conferences, do you do a lot of speaking?
Yeah, you could say that. I sort of slowed down a little bit on the speaking only to focus more on my business. The last place I spoke was last year at Facebook. I closed out their design lecture series. I will be doing some more speaking coming up soon. I'll be speaking at MailChimp in March. And then there's possibly, it's not finalized yet, so I don't want to announce it, but there are 2 or 3 other opportunities in the near future.
And what topics do you speak on?
I speak on everything from starting side projects to building your business. I talk about diversity in design. That's been a big thing, not just for the podcast, but also through a lot of advocacy work that I do through AIGA. Those are kind of the main
topics. What's AIGA?
AIGA is the American Institute of Graphic Arts. It's a 100-plus year design organization. Stems across a lot of design, not just web and graphic. I mean, there's photographers, there's painters, sculptors, pretty much the scope of fine arts.
And then, so when you're doing these topics, do you help companies kind of embrace the diversity and open up to, you know, Black designers? Do you help them in that area?
Yeah. And to be clear, I mean, we're talking about diversity, and I know that my work has generally been focused on Black designers and Black professionals, but diversity in and of itself is a spectrum. It ranges across a number of different demographic fields. I spoke before about age, geography,
right,
sexual orientation, ableness, et cetera. I do help companies with that. I've done that in the past for Vox Media. I've done it with a few other companies just doing consulting on looking at their current workforce, sort of quantifying where they see the best need at, and then putting together an action plan so they can try to bring in more employees along that line.
Now, what you may not know, Lee, but I discovered in my extensive pre-show research just before I went to the lobby and got everybody, Maurice is a mathematician. He can help Max with his homework.
<There you go. laughs>
But that's another one of those kind of, what do you call those things? Paradox, right? Oxymoron. Has that had any impact? And if so, what kind of impact on how you approach this whole thing?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because I often do get befuddled looks from people, because I am a designer, But I didn't go to design school. I didn't study design. I studied math. My undergraduate degree is in math from here in Atlanta at Morehouse College. And then my graduate degree is in telecommunications management. What I tell people is that math really teaches you how to think. Math teaches you how to structure your thoughts. Math teaches you how to analyze and break down problems. Yes, it's about numbers and letters and variables and differentials and things of that nature. But really, at the end of the day, math helps you to structure your thoughts in an organized way. And so that's helped me in many different ways, from writing to doing proposals to attacking design problems to doing design research. It all sort of factors in.
Now, can you share a little bit and maybe educate our listeners if they are thinking, you know what, I want to up my game in terms of design, because I would think you would agree that most businesses don't invest enough in design.
Sure.
What are some baby steps a company can take to kind of up their game?
I think companies really need to be open-minded and look at the value of design. If there's one thing that I would say is a commonality among many designers that I've spoken with, is that when they work for companies, whether it's at an employee level or as a freelancer, the companies don't really see the value of design. It's hard for them to quantify what that really means for their brand or what that means for their customers. It's harder for them to measure than, say, you know, doing consulting or another type of service, because design tends to, I don't know, it can sometimes have a very ephemeral quality to it. And it can look like the work that we do is fairly easy because it's, oh, we're looking at
like
colors
the Nike
and numbers.
Swish.
And,
how, you know, what was that, 5 minutes to come up with that?
Right, but
they've only been using that brand for how long?
Exactly, but it takes years of practice and study and interaction to get to the point where you can make something like that in 5 minutes, or to make it look easy. There's a lot of work that goes into it to make it look easy. So companies really need to start valuing design, I think, just as important as other aspects of their business. Because, you know, one thing I tell a lot of people is that we all innately are designers. Everything that we have interacted with since birth has passed through some level of design, whether it's the clothes we wear, the chairs we sit in, the cars we drive. We all instinctively, innately know when something has been poorly designed. And so because we all have that sort of sense of knowing that, we can all input in some sort of way what design should look like, what design should feel like. I think anyone that has a business, whether you're an entrepreneur or an employee, you know what looks good. You know what doesn't look good. That in some small sense is design.
Yeah, we had a guest in here recently that said when they ask children, like in elementary school, first grade, are you an artist? They all raise their hand. Like, who's an artist? They all raise their hand. But like by fifth grade, like only the one kid that can draw well raises their hand. They stop even considering themselves as being an artist.
Yeah. I don't want to get into how the American education system functions in terms of kind of snuffing that out. But that is something when I think companies talk about the pipeline, for example. There's a lot of talk about the pipeline, usually in technology, but I think it also extends through to design as well. You know, when all of us were kids, we were all finger painting and drawing and doing things. But as we got older, that got to be replaced with social sciences and math and, you know, other things like that. And what I'm often finding is I'll talk to high schoolers or something like that, and they don't really realize that what they do, drawing and things like that, can be a profession. And part of that is, I think, because the general design community is not doing enough kind of giving back in that respect. Design, largely because of technology, is a field that has really sort of exploded within the past 15 years. Technology has really democratized it, so a lot of people can use programs and create design all over the world. So because things are changing so quickly, there's a lot of looking forward, but there's not a lot of looking back. And so you may have students that are interested, that might have the talent, might have the proficiency, but they don't know that this is an actual viable thing that they can do, because design is one of those few fields where you can be really successful without a degree. It's just about the work that you do.
Now, when you're working with a client, can you walk us through what it's like from your initial consultation with them to actually doing projects or work?
Sure. So I do an initial consultation, just as you mentioned, just to get a sense of what their business is about, what their business goals are, and how that relates to the project that they have at hand. From there, depending on the project, usually if it is a design project, We'll start doing sketches for wireframes or for logos or, you know, things like that. Maybe a mood board or something if it's a branding or an identity project, just to make sure that I'm getting in the right mindset of what they're looking for what they need from the project. And I sort of take, I want to say like a waterfall approach in that I don't try to move forward on anything until I get their full approval at that step. So we're not moving forward to mock-ups until we make sure the wireframes are done. We're not moving forward to coding or doing anything until we make sure that the layout and everything is perfect, the colors are right, this is exactly what you want. Because that way, once we get started, we can then take an iterative approach once we've started designing or coding to start making small changes in the project based on what we've already kind of accepted. And then we get to the point where it's at a good spot. They like it. I like it. We ship it. And that's that.
Now, do you find that most clients maybe that are new to design, they have a hard time visualizing what the finished product's going to be?
Yes.
So how do you work through that?
Well, designers, in some sense, almost have to be therapists. I think it's really important to make sure that you're asking the right questions to get what you need from the client. So if it's, I'll give you an example. There's a project, not going to name the client, but there's a project that I'm working on right now. And I sort of have the sense of what they want. We've done a mood board. We've sort of put it out there.
Like, what's a mood board? What does that mean?
So the way that I categorize a mood board is essentially a series of images and colors and things that will inspire it's like an inspiration board. It gives them the motif that they want for the project. It's really more important that I do that with branding and identity projects. Sometimes we'll go through exercises with words, you know, just to get an idea of where they're at mentally for their brand. Like, when people think of your brand, what do you want them to...
Right, like, are you Nordstrom? Are you Target? Are you Walmart?
Word association. We'll put out color swatches. I'll do images. I'll send music. I'll do typefaces, like, just to get a general idea of what this is. So they can keep that in mind throughout the project as we progress, because not every part of the project is going to be that fun. I try to put the fun at the beginning.
Right. Lead with the fun. That's
right.
A good
lead
tip.
With the fun. So by the time we get to the point where I'm really working and coding and making sure that it's right, we're looking back at that as inspiration to make sure that this is exactly what they're looking for.
And so you're able to kind of walk them through. So at the end, there's no surprise, like they don't say, where'd this come from? Because they've kind of approved it at every step.
Right. I try to make sure that the client is with me in the project every step of the way. I don't want them at any point to feel like, well, I don't know what Marius is doing. I don't know what they're working on. It's like, no, we know every step where we're at. I keep them on track usually every week, and we make it happen.
Now, is there a project you're most proud of?
Ooh, client project or personal project?
I'll go with personal, because that way you don't get in trouble.
Good answer. I will say probably Revision Path is the one that I'm the most proud of, because it's something that even years and years later, I'm still super excited about. I get to meet so many amazing people when I talk to folks every week, not just here in the U.S., but all over the world. I've managed to build a big network because of it. I've learned so much from what other designers are doing. And I've even built, you know, a community around it. I mean, a lot of people have sought out Revision Path when they're looking for designers of color. This is February. This is Black History Month. We also have a sister site called 28 Days of the Web that we've been doing for the past 4 years. We just surpassed 100 designers there, where we introduce a different designer or developer every day in conjunction with and in celebration of Black History Month. So the fact that it's now becoming this platform where people can come and try to find designers that look like them or companies that are trying to diversify their workforce, they can come and find people that, oh, this is someone I didn't know about, or for conferences that are looking for speakers or blogs that are looking for people to feature. We've ended up becoming this platform and this community now for people to do just that.
That's one of the I guess secrets of podcasting is the network you build is outside of just the content you create.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not everybody realized that going in.
Well, I think it might depend on the kind of show that you do. I mean, because we're an interview-based show and we come out every week, it's something where every week they can find out about something new. They can find out what this person is working on and, you know, really just build their network as they're learning. They can even learn about different types of design they didn't even know existed. I've certainly gotten emails from people that said, I didn't even know that blank was something that I could do, now I want to go into that. You know, that's amazing to hear that.
All right, it's time for our Let's Help Kelly segment. Right. So my youngest, Kelly,
okay,
and I should know exactly how old she is, but let's say she's in 19, 20, something like that.
Okay.
She's either 19 or 20, but she very much wants to be in your world, I think. She's been taking design classes. Now her dad thinks she's just the most gifted thing on the planet. Mm-hmm. But in all seriousness, advice, counsel for young people that think they may want to enter into this arena, maybe some do's or don'ts as they're kind of trying to navigate this path.
Do's and don'ts. Do have a website that is your name, I think. And when I say that, I mean it's, you know, as close as you can get to your first name, last name.com. So I have MauriceCherry.com, for example, just from a branding, you know.
So personal
standpoint.
Branding, very important.
Personal branding, okay. Very important. Speaking of which, I will be judging. It's actually coming up right now, but it's the Howe Promotion and Design Awards. I wanted to make sure to throw that out. So if people are interested and want to submit, the deadline is March 13th for that. But yes, personal branding, very important. I think at any age, but particularly when you're younger, because as you build your body of work, you want that to be the base for it. And so if you have it on your own platform with your own name, no one can get confused about that. That's your thing. Building out, I think case studies is important. What I see a lot of designers sometimes do is just have a lot of pretty pictures, but don't actually explain the methodology behind why they created something or what their design decisions were. And that helps not only just for clients, that helps for employers. It helps them to see what kind of a designer you are, how thoughtful you are, what you consider when you go into design. It's not just sitting in front of Photoshop or Sketch and just doing a bunch of doodles. It's saying, okay, I did some surveys or I got some data and I decided to do this. You know, it's making sure that you're painting yourself as more than just, I don't want to say more than just an artist. I don't want to say that. But you're painting yourself as someone that thinks about and takes into consideration how other things factor into design. So I think those two things are important.
Wow, I'm glad I asked. What fantastic counsel. All right, let's make sure that our listeners, and believe me, one of them is going to be Kelly. I'm going to make sure she hears the on-demand version of this interview for sure. But want to make sure that they know how to get in touch with you. So email, website, LinkedIn, whatever is appropriate. And let's make sure that you plug this upcoming event one more time too.
Yes, sure. So you can always reach me at mauricecherry.com. There you'll find links to my studio, Lunch. You'll find links to Revision Path. If you want to find them just separately, Lunch's website is yepitslunch.com. That's yepitslunch.com. Revision Path is just revisionpath.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn, but if you add me on LinkedIn, please, please write a note. I get dozens of LinkedIn requests every day, and no one writes a note. It's just, this person would, you know, like to accept your connection. It would be good to have a reason behind it so I know who this person is and why I should add them.
Jimmy Etheridge is over here nodding his head.
Amen.
Please add a note if you're going to add me on LinkedIn, but you can just search for Maurice Cherry and I'm there.
You got it, man. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey, hang out with us. We got one more guest we're going to visit with.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And before we do that again, the event, it's the Howe Promotion and Design Awards. You can just go to I think it's howdesign.com, and you'll see I'm one of the judges along with Charles S. Anderson and Yo Santosa, and the deadline for that is March 13th.
All right. Fantastic. All right, Lee, you ready for the headliner?
I am.
She's been sitting there so patiently. She's been nodding her head a lot through both segments. I think I caught her taking some notes.
Wow.
No stranger to the Business Radio X microphone, so we know that she's engaging and bright and passionate. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast with the Museum of Design Atlanta, Dr. Laura Flushi. How are you?
I'm great. Couldn't be happier to be here with an innovator and a designer.
That's I'll it. Bet. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Laura, can you share a little bit about Moda? What are you guys doing for folks?
Oh man, we are doing a lot right now. So Moda, the Museum of Design Atlanta, is the only design museum in the southeastern United States. If people aren't familiar with us, we're located in Midtown, just across the street from the Woodruff Arts Center. And we put up exhibitions and run programs that look at design as a process that can inspire change transform lives and make the world a better place. And so right now we have up an exhibition, just opened a couple weeks ago. It's getting some really great reviews, which is great, called Food by Design, Sustaining the Future. And it looks at the American food system with a few forays off, off the continent. But it looks at the American food system and recognizes that we have a food system in the United States that doesn't serve us so well always in terms of health for everyone.
Nutrition.
Nutrition, accessibility for everyone, mm-hmm. environmental sustainability. And it also says, well, you know, the food system is so big and it touches every second of every single one of our lives. No one's going to sit down and like call Maurice and say, would you redesign the food system? That's not going to happen, probably.
He's busy.
Yeah.
I would like that project, actually. But.
Let's talk. No. So it really presents the idea that in order to change the food system, there's going to have to be a lot of innovation across a really broad spectrum of fields, from farming to how we compost, to how we deal with food waste, to what guerrilla gardeners do when they go out and plant food in public spaces, to the way farmers markets look. So it presents a lot of projects that are being done by really interesting designers, farmers, scientists, innovators, engineers, and so on. So we're pretty excited about that.
Now, is that up and running?
Yeah, it's up and running until May 7th.
So what's an example of one of the things you'll see there?
Oh, there's so many awesome ones. So the exhibition kicks off with a look at urban agriculture. So as probably most people know, the majority of the world is now living in an urban environment. That proportion will get much larger over the course of the next decades. And so one of the big problems we're facing is, how do you grow food somewhere else and effectively and in an environmentally sustainable way get it to those cities? Or is there another way to do it? And urban agriculture is really becoming a big part of that. So it looks at the trend towards vertical farming. One particularly big company called Arrow Farms that's doing some really interesting work out of Newark, New Jersey, looks at another vertical farming project happening in London where they've taken bomb shelters underneath the city and it's called Growing Underground, and they've installed vertical farms there, and they claim they can get their greens and their herbs to people from basically farm to fork in about 40 minutes.
Wow.
So really decreasing that transport time, saving a lot of carbon emissions and so on.
So now you also recently were included in the book, 100 Things to Do in Atlanta Before You Die. How did that come about?
We're awesome.
How about that?
Yeah. We're one of the 100 things to do before you die. I don't actually know exactly how it came about, but we're pretty happy about it.
So you were just kind of chosen because you are awesome?
Yes.
And then are you guys always looking for members?
Or
how does that work, your funding?
Yeah. So at Moda, good question. So our funding happens in a couple different ways. We earn some funds from people who come in and buy a ticket or become a member, who maybe attend one of the lectures that we're offering. We have a big lecture series going on this year, who maybe enroll their children in our summer camps. We have a lot of summer camps that in which young people learn to use design thinking in conjunction with STEM technologies to address real world problems. So we earn some money that way. Of course, we're always looking for contributed income as well. So we have foundations, individuals, and corporate entities that support us because they believe, like we do, that design is a really important tool for solving 21st century problems.
Now, you mentioned before the show, I think, that you're also a meeting place for some organizations.
We are a meeting place, in particular for AIGA, which is the American Institute of Graphic Artists, which Maurice is in leadership, I think, here in Atlanta. Is that right?
Oh, no. I'm on the National Diversity and Inclusion Task Force, but I'm just a chapter member here in Atlanta.
I'm going with leadership.
I call that leadership.
So AIGA uses us as their home base for a lot of their meetings. Other corporate entities often come in and rent the space because it's a really creative, interesting space to either bring clients to for an evening or to have team meetings. We do some team building with corporations. So yeah, there's a lot of thinking going on there often. So,
Accenture, we used it a year ago around the fashion design display for a client event. It was fantastic.
Cool. Come back.
So now, can you share how you work with a client like an Accenture to kind of create an event for them?
Sure. There's a whole variety of possibilities. So someone usually calls us and says, we have this challenge. It might be we need to entertain some clients, or it might be we want to get millennials out of the office and get them engaged somewhere. Or it might be we have a creative team or some kind of team that needs to be offsite in a place that really stimulates them to think differently. So we create events sometimes. We do some design thinking with corporations to either teaching them how design thinking works or addressing a particular problem that they have. We also create really fun events for them. A really popular one is Legos and Local Brew. So teams come in and we put the Legos out. We have so many Legos. And we serve local beer. And they respond to some Lego challenges and just have a lot
Lego
of fun.
Lego challenges?
Yeah. There's
like, what's
big competition.
A Lego challenge?
Like, build your favorite food out of Lego. Yeah. We also arrange for people to use our space at times that we're closed to the public. So you might be able to have a big brainstorm session in one of our galleries, something mm-hmm. like that.
And use that as inspiration?
Yeah.
Now, how do you do with tourism? Is tourism a big part of your business?
We do get a lot of tourists. So we get a couple different kinds of tourists, I would say. We get tourists who are in Atlanta and simply are museum goers or really interested in culture and so want to know what's out there, and they come in the door. And one of the great things about our location is since we're across the street from the Woodruff Arts Center, you know, obviously they're attracting those tourists too. So that's great for us. We also get tourists who I would say are design tourists. So there really are not that many design museums in the United States. Mm-hmm. They're all really different. There's not really a norm for what a design museum is. So a lot of designers check them out when they go to different cities. And so we see a lot of designers coming in too.
And then, like Jimmy mentioned, in the past you had the fashion exhibition. Did you do some 3D printing? Didn't you do that also?
We did. So a few years ago, we brought 3D printers into our lobby.
That was early on 3D printing, right?
It was kind of early on, yeah. And we started teaching classes for adults and kids, which we still do, that teaches you to design something that can be 3D printed. And that became really popular. But we also noticed that because the 3D printers were always working in our lobbies, people would come in and they really had 30 minutes worth of questions about how does this work? What is it doing in the world? I've never seen one. I've only heard about them. And we had so much fun answering all those questions for our visitors that we decided that it would be really interesting to put together an exhibition that showed, you know, those were desktop printers making plastic stuff that we have or that we have now in our lobby. But 3D printing is so much bigger. We wanted to really demonstrate
what can be done out there.
Yeah. So we had a 3D printed dress. So how is it changing fashion? Custom 3D printed shoes. We had examples of people building houses by 3D printing.
Did you have a Chattanooga firm?
We did. We had a Chattanooga firm, and they're working on a way to construct walls of unusual shape that are mm-hmm. 3D printed.
It's really amazing when it opens your mind, like you said, about inspiration to go in there and just be around all that.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what we're hoping for. Design is a great tool. Everybody may not become a designer with a capital D, but they can adopt designer mindsets to address challenges, and we're hoping people leave with that idea.
So I asked Jimmy this, I'll ask you, what do you need more from us? How can we help you?
That's a great question. We need awareness. We want people to know about us. So we moved to Midtown about 6 years ago and people are still becoming aware of us. We also really need corporate partners. We want to partner with people who believe in our exhibitions and our programs and want to help us put great things into the Atlanta community around design and innovation.
Right. And not just in a philanthropic way. There's like a real ROI portion to what you do that can really help the business grow their business, right?
Absolutely. Yes. So philanthropic investments are always great. Don't get me wrong. But we really want to partner with people and say, you know, what do we have? How can we help you access design and the way designers think to improve your business as well?
So now, if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
I would start with our website, the MODA website, which is www.museumofdesign.org. And then LinkedIn is a great way, or Twitter, to get a hold of me as well.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
My pleasure.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton and all of our guests. Thank you for listening. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.